Can you hear me, ladies and gentlemen? Is that better? Can you hear me now? Good evening, everyone. Welcome to you all. I'm Andy Haynes from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and it's a great pleasure for me to welcome you here this evening. This is the first in a series of events on controversies in global health. The next one will be on nuclear energy, and we're hoping to revise the date of that soon. The series is organised by the Centre on Global Change and Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And the purpose really is to encourage debate on controversial issues in global health. I'm particularly grateful to Shari Kovacs and to Kelly Lee for organising this event, and for Ella Govill as well. The speakers this evening, I think, are going to give us a very fine event. First speaker is Derek Yak, someone I've known for a long time since he worked at WHO as the Executive Director of Non-Communicable Diseases. He was appointed in January 2007 as the PepsiCo Director of Global Health Policy, and he'll be talking to us from that perspective. And the second speaker will be Philip James, who established the International Obesity Task Force, for which he's currently the chair. So Derek, let's start with you. We're going to ask each speaker to talk for 25 minutes, and then we're going to have some open interaction between the speakers and the audience. So Derek, over to you. Welcome.
Thanks, Andy. Wonderful to be here, and particularly have the opportunity to share a platform with Phil. I think when you're sitting there starting to look at the slide, the first point I need to make is that people often confuse PepsiCo, the company, with Pepsi, the brand. And what I hope you get is a sense of a diverse portfolio that is becoming increasingly diverse, with a range of products stretching all the way through from Quaker, Tropicana, through Frito-Lay, and a myriad of products through the fruit juice categories, Gatorade, including Pepsi-Cola, of which the soda category is now about 20% or less of our total revenue worldwide. That becomes important when I start advancing the debate. I came across a fascinating quote recently by Rosabeth Cantor-Moss of the Harvard Business Review. Basically, what she said I would agree with strongly. When giants transform themselves from impersonal machines into human communities, they gain the ability to transform the world around them in very positive ways. Values turn out to be the key ingredient in the most vibrant and successful multinational corporations. I've had the great opportunity to serve in different types of roles in private, public, not-for-profit, and foundation communities. And I think we're at an important landmark in the way we think about corporations and their general role in the world. That has been brought about by many factors, the most recent being, of course, the recession that we're heading into, and an understanding of some of the deeper causes of the recession. We've seen in the last year or years people like Muhammad Yunus start talking about new notions of business, calling for a focus on social business. We have seen Bill Gates starting to try and redefine the role of business as he transitioned from Microsoft, the company, to the foundation, talking about creative capitalism. And in our company, our CEO, Indra Noy, has been talking about what does it mean to be a good company? A very simple question with a very complex answer. Her answer, and the reason I joined the company, was that she believes that we need to focus as much on our purpose in society as we do on our financial performance, and has coined our overarching theme of performance with purpose as the driving force of the company. What I've seen inside the corporations has been that we're not alone. Many companies out there are trying to link their social goal with their financial obligations to their shareholders. When we start turning to the specific question, I would argue that it's no longer a question of asking what roles companies should play, but rather to an acknowledgement of the role that they are playing and appreciate the fact that they will continue to expand that role, both because of outside pressures of a wide variety, and those pressures come from the investment community, they come from the shareholders, they come from governments, and most importantly, they come from our consumers, who increasingly demand change in the type of products and the access to them. And as a company that in the end will only survive if it responds to the needs of its consumers, we will continue to move down a journey of change, which will take obviously many years to completely achieve. There will be many in the audience who will obviously be skeptical about the role of companies like PepsiCo and will ask the obvious question. You make soda and chips. How can you, as a company that makes soda and chips, claim your right to play a role in the epidemic that we believe is entirely caused by soda and chips? By the way, that was the question my mother asked me when I joined the company almost 2 years ago. And it's a question that can be answered in many ways. It can be answered by saying, by going into the deep analysis of the past and the history of how we got to where we are, going through what I think Roberts and others have done extremely well in their book, The End of Food, where they do analyze all the major factors that led us to the point we're at now, which relate to the demand for food following the wars, the demand for food to meet the nutrient needs of a population, the demand to start bringing into effect a modern, efficient system to ensure that the food was supplied in safe and sufficient amount. The way we actually set our agricultural subsidies over the decades, the way we set and train a process of events that have led us to where we are now, where food for some is plentiful, cheap, and may be high in saturated fat, sugar, and salt, whereas for many, food is in a lack of abundance. We could go into that debate, but I don't think that that is particularly useful. I think what's more useful to ask is where are companies today and where they're headed in future? What is it that we could be doing to do better to address the major nutrition crises, including obesity? And while my colleagues are coming to the corridor, let me turn back a couple of years to when I last had a chance to address Andy's great hallowed institution, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. I was shocked to see that almost 14 years have passed since I was a Heath Clark lecturer at the school. And Kelly will probably remember that the topic dealt with globalization and health 14 years ago. My sister was in the audience, and I'm pleased she's with me today, being a true Londoner here. But think about 14 years ago. Where were we? There was no Gates Foundation involved in health. There was no Gavi. There was no GAIN. There was no global fund. You could argue that global health 14 years ago was dictated by the UN, particularly WHO and UNICEF, and on the foundation side, virtually only the Rockefeller Foundation stood alone. What has happened over time? Well, first, we saw dramatic changes as a result of the entry of the global, of the Gates Foundation. We started seeing data saying it's unacceptable to allow the slow pace of change, and private-public partnerships started to form. The creation of GAIN has already resulted in 650 million people receiving fortified products that would never have got it. We now have millions of people receiving vaccines through the Global Vaccine Alliance, supported again by the Gates Foundation, the Norwegian governments, and others. We've seen the creation of the Global Fund for AIDS, Malaria, and TB, something unthinkable, and the investment of many billions of dollars into an area, many of which happening because of partnerships between the pharmaceutical industry and the public sector and the research community. Those may be awkward facts for people to remember, but they are the truth. They have resulted in the saving of lives like we have never seen. We would have continued down the slow path of change if we actually hadn't had the partnerships which got created over the last decade in the area of pharmaceutical companies and many in the public sector. In creating them, there was a lot of pain, there was a lot of angst, and I sat in WHO and watched the creation of many of these. We were very concerned that the entire agenda for infectious diseases was going to be taken over by the private sector, and that the corporations were going to ruin the world for infectious disease control. I would argue, in fact, the opposite is happening. We are seeing access improve. We now have over 3 million people on access to drugs for AIDS that theoretically should be priced probably 10 to 50 times more than they are now. But due to a combination of NGO pressure, government action, and in the end, pharmaceutical company relooking at their fundamental business models, we now have access increasing steadily and people's lives being saved. I mention that because that was an era and experience I lived through at WHO. I was not in the infectious disease world. I was in the area of chronic diseases. We sat there watching this happen and wondered, why was it that there was so much interest in working with the pharmaceutical industry and so little interest in working with other companies who could advance the common goals of global health? During that time, as you may know, Dr. Brundtland started trying to deepen some of these relationships. And I had the opportunity to work on tobacco control. And you may know that the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control galvanized the global NGO community probably like never before. And we led to the fastest adoption of a UN treaty, now adopted by 163 countries. On the eve of the adoption of the treaty, I got a phone call from the New York Times. They wanted to know what was next in terms of the world of treaties. Were we planning a fast food treaty? Of course, maybe not of course. My answer was a profound no. And this was 2003. The reason I said no was by then, I'd already started work with my colleagues, including Phil, on what we needed to do to start addressing diet and physical activity. And certainly it was a feeling among many of us that the simple prescription of what we did for tobacco would have little application except in galvanizing global opinion to the approach that was going to be required in food for many reasons, and I'm sure we'll debate those reasons. Primary among them is the fact that obviously in the case of tobacco you're using with one product that if stopped would have enormous sudden impact on global mortality and for which there were not that many substitutes once you closed down the sources of nicotine addiction. We started at that time the work on the global strategy, and what was the toughest part was to start understanding that we needed to take a different direction. We recognized that we needed to have on board the best that we could from the food industry, otherwise our efforts would go up in smoke. I can recall sitting with Phil James, in a little restaurant in Ferney-Voltaire, probably at the start of this journey on the global strategy, where I asked Phil to tell me about his experience in developing the dietary guidelines for health developed under what was called Technical Report 797 almost 20 years ago. The story was one that needs to be told, and hopefully you'll tell a bit of it, but it was one of the industry causing incredible pressure to result in a report that came out and never was implemented. When we started a report revising the dietary guidelines, we wanted to make sure that this report led to action, which it did. The development of it was chaired by Ricardo Wawi, and when it came out, of course, we united the entire food sector against us initially, and we recognized that we had to move on. We went to the legal counsel and said that to ensure its survival, we needed to talk to the private sector. And that's where the response became interesting. The strongest resistance to talking initially came from within WHO, who felt that merely talking to the food industry would constitute a severe conflict of interest and one that would undermine our ability to develop sensible policies. Dr. Brundtland, the wiser, I would argue, than the legal counsel, felt we had to push on, and we had unprecedented discussions with both the NGO community and with the food industry that led to the first CEO roundtable with the food industry. I mention that past because during that period, it was the responsibility of our team to write out what we thought the private sector should do to address chronic diseases and specifically obesity. And we laid out in the action plan a series of steps, many of which you'd recognize as being kind of obvious. Reduce the level of saturated fats, salts, and sugars. focus on some of the issues related to product reformulation. Address marketing to children without being too prescriptive about exactly what that meant. Ensure that labeling was available and sensibly applied so that people understood it. Strengthen the role of physical activity across the world and make it more accessible to people. Strengthen the role of research through the private sector. At that point, I left WHO, and a few years later, I got called up by Indra Nooyi, our CEO, and given this great opportunity to join a company, with her view being that we have a chance through the company to make a significant difference to the world of chronic diseases and obesity. When I thought about it, it was very clear that my job description had already been written at WHO. Not just my job description, but the job that we in industry needed to do. So it was not surprising when in 2008 we started bringing together our colleagues across the corporate world, which now include 9 major companies with combined revenues of $350 billion, active in 200 countries around the world. Then coming together, taking that very action plan and turning it into a formal letter of commitment to Dr. Chan, the Director General of WHO, saying that we hereby commit to get engaged in product reformulation with some details, marketing, labeling, physical activity, and so on. That was in May 2008. In December 2008, the first of the required commitments started rolling out, and that is a global restriction on marketing to children worldwide, which will go into effect over the next 18 months and be accepted by all the 9 companies. It will also be supported by an independent monitoring and verification system, because we recognize that we don't expect you to trust our word, and we don't trust ourselves to trust any individual company unless it is subject to an independent verification, in a similar way that we are seeing an independent verification being put in place in the context of the EU pledge, where 2 major audit companies, Pricewaterhouse and Accenture, are involved. If we go through the list of commitments on product reformulation, we've seen since the start of the work over the last few years something like 10,000 products across our companies being reformulated. These cost the companies many millions of dollars, and not all the cost is recouped in terms of the increased profitability. An example being the removal of trans fats in many markets doesn't confer financial benefit on the company. It's done because it's the right thing to do. It's not done because there's legislation in the company. It's done because we know the evidence shows harm and we will take it out. We know in the UK that we've seen a steady, slow reduction in salt, sugar, and saturated fat, which will have an impact on chronic disease in general, but also on the obesity epidemic long term. We've seen a step up in terms of new product and new acquisitions, whether it's in our company or across many of the companies. The product reformulation area, to my mind, is the part long term that has the greatest promise to impact on the obesity epidemic. And the reason is that we will be able to change the energy density and the portion size, which we know independently impact on the obesity epidemic. We're starting to see work on portion size, whether it's the lower calorie packs or whether or changing energy density, but trying to reduce the level of sugar and certainly fat, both will have a big impact. The bigger impacts are going to come as we transform our entire portfolios, and that the food available increasingly starts off by being in the healthiest possible category. I can't speak for other companies, but certainly I can say that our company looks through the lens of the healthfulness of a future product that we may acquire, where the first question is, will it accelerate our transformation of our total portfolio towards a healthy portfolio? If the answer is no, even though it may be profitable, we have turned down those companies as joining our stable. If the answer is yes, we will start looking at it more seriously. Proof of that also is that for product reformulation, you need good research and development. And I'm thrilled I've got a number of my colleagues from our plant up in Nesta with us as living proof of the fact that you have real scientists in the company spending weeks, months, years trying to reformulate products and think of a better way of accelerating our transformation towards the healthfulness part of the portfolio. For us as a company, our transformation to R&D has been going on for a while, but what is new is the fact that we've now brought in a chief scientific officer who doesn't come from the world of food science. He comes from having spent many years heading obesity and metabolic research at the Mayo Clinic and heading Takeda Pharmaceuticals' worldwide R&D operations for the development of drugs aimed at treating diabetes and addressing obesity and cardiovascular disease. Why are we bringing in people with that kind of background? And he's not alone. Simply because we believe that the transformations that we're about to start seeing will no longer see research aligned simply with a change in color or taste or flavorant, but with true functional change, where the outcome is measured in terms of its impact on metabolic disease, on obesity, and on cardiovascular disease, mentioning a few. But it's not only that area that we're seeing a transformation. Across the companies, I mentioned the marketing policy. I could also mention the schools policy. We're at the start of trying to define across the world what we might do better in terms of schools policy. Already in the US, through a voluntary agreement under the Alliance for a Healthier Generation, which includes the Clinton Foundation, American Heart Association, many major companies and NGOs, over the last 2 years, we've seen a 60% reduction of calories shipped into the schools of the USA. That's 60% on top of what kids may be consuming, 60% less calories. You can translate that into an absolute reduction in the amount of calories being consumed by kids in the US. In time, that'll be one small but important contribution to lowering the calorie intake of kids in the school system. We know we can do more. We can do it globally, and we've already started discussions with the World Heart Foundation about expanding many of those aspects globally. Before ending, I would just say that we have other activities underway, which hopefully in question time we will get to. As a company, we recognize that it's not good enough only to focus on marketing, labeling, product reformulation, but we also need to invest in physical activity. And that's where we find the story of damned if you do and damned if you don't. We know from the Foresight report that the central issue in obesity relates to energy balance. So while we focus on product reformulation, we need to focus on physical activity. When we touch physical activity, many critics would say we're simply trying to divert attention away from our products. The point I would make is say that we're doing both. Not only are we doing both in terms of what you'd expect, I think many people are surprised when we point out that for the developing world, perhaps some of the greatest threats to the consequences of obesity lie in us ignoring the consequences of undernutrition. Many of the cohort studies are showing that children who are born stunted and go through a period of rapid growth will actually be at greater risk of diabetes and cardiovascular disease in the early and late childhood than children in, say, the West, where you didn't see that transition occurring. For that reason, and because of its direct humanitarian effect, the company at the level of the CEO is supporting major initiatives starting to tackle undernutrition. We recognize this is not going to be easy because it takes us into some of the most contentious areas of public health. How do we do this in a way in which we are supportive of the code of infant formula and strengthening breastfeeding marketing, the marketing and support for breastfeeding worldwide? As a company, we certainly recognize that breastfeeding remains perhaps our most cost-effective, least marketed, least supported intervention for nutrition across the lifespan. What does a corporation do to actually show that it's serious about doing it? And that is actually a challenge I'd throw out to the audience. Before ending, let me just say that I could add in a range of other activities about what we are doing, what we plan to do. But we are fairly humble about it because we know that while we may have a large joint amount of revenue, $350 billion is a reasonable amount of money and a reasonable amount of impact. We can have an impact both in terms of our own direct company's actions. We can lever the actions of many other companies. But unless government step up to the plate as well, unless academics support us in doing the kind of research that will advance the actionable parts of our agenda, unless the NGO community start actually realizing that critique is important to continue, but actually providing the direction for the future is going to perhaps be even more important, very clear direction, we won't make progress. Our challenge is to say that while we believe that we have actually seen that we have a critical role to play, we believe that the other sectors need to step up to the plate as forcefully and strongly as we are. Thank you.
Well, many thanks, Derek, for giving us such a great start. I'd now like to introduce Philip James, who, as you have heard, is a great world-recognized expert in obesity. He was responsible, among other things, for the Department of Health guidelines on obesity, and he chairs the International Task Force on Obesity. Hopefully we can unclog the computer.
I'm not sure what it's done.
Thank you very much indeed. Glad to be here. The title relates not specifically to Pepsi, but to the role of the corporate sector. And in this environment, as distinct from the School of Hygiene, I wasn't entirely sure who might turn up. So those of you, I thought I'd show a few slides to keep me on track, but those of you who've seen them before, I apologize. Derek, are we able to?
I had to reboot.
What I wanted to do, first of all, was to start off by saying we're talking about a global epidemic. This is quite astonishing in its extent, and people don't realize just what an enormous impact it has had. I'm going to show you in a few seconds a range of issues, but the key factor is this is not a Western problem. Derek's talked about undernutrition and so on. The most catastrophic changes are occurring in the poorer countries of the world. And indeed, if you look at the WHO analyses of the complications, namely diabetes, cancer, heart disease, stroke, and so on, they kill, roughly speaking, 4 to 5 times as many people in the poorer countries as in the West. So we have a completely distorted view of what the global problem is. And we don't realize just how dramatic the changes have been. And these changes are now driven so fast and so far by the problem of obesity that we are being bombarded through several different routes. Not simply ministers of health wailing about the fact that they're incapable of managing their health budgets, but actually ministers of finance and prime ministers who are saying, what the devil do we do about this? Because the financial analyses suggest that no country on earth is going to be able to keep up with the escalating health costs of what we call routine medical care. And this is going to get worse, and one of the principal factors is the obesity epidemic. It's not simply, of course, if you're dealing with these sort of problems, you say, as many ministers of health told me, and they were extremely bored by the problem, because you've got to die of something. And since strokes and so on affect the elderly, particularly if you're like me under the age of 40, that, of course, won't come for a very long time. But now we recognize that there's a huge problem of obesity coming in children. And none of those, even the wonderful Oxford analyses for the Foresight Report, have done a fundamental lock-in of the implications of the current global epidemic with the escalation that we know from a whole series of analyses are going to make things much worse. Roughly speaking, 5 years ago, we said that 5%, 1 in 20 children in the world, were already designated as overweight and obese. Recently, we've partially updated our data, and already it's looking as though 1 in 10, or 10% of the world's children, are overweight or obese. And if you look at the global epidemic, for example, of diabetes, I'm not allowed to tell you the data on the diabetes rates in some countries, because it's seen as so embarrassing that it's going to be extremely difficult for people to actually understand what to do. And if one actually then asks, why are we having this extraordinary epidemic, and what's the overall impact, then we can see that not only do we have an enormous global burden, but we can dissect out the analyses of what the nature of the problem. And already in Western countries, if you look at the analyses which some of you may know, where at the time of the millennium, we did the first ever scrutiny of why on earth all the health problems are affecting the world at large. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about HIV, malaria, tuberculosis, and so on. Let's put it all together and see what the principal killers are. The global epidemic. And if you then include disabilities and recognise, of course, that if you're malnourished and these children die by the million at the age of one or two, then they're missing 74 years, 75. You're allowed to live to 75 these days, according to WHO. So they miss 74 years. So if you stack that up, of course, malnutrition comes out right up at the top. But once you take that away, you're now into fundamental issues relating to, guess what? Smoking, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, high body weight, poor intake of fruits and vegetables, physical inactivity, alcohol. Good heavens, that's quite extraordinary, isn't it? Because I've talked about fundamental issues affecting the total global health burden. Thank you, Derek.
Do you want me to keep going?
Which is actually quite astonishing. Let's keep with this. I'll play.
Okay.
Here's an example of the Middle East. We're not talking about a problem which is a public health issue. We're talking about a problem where this is 80% of the population of women in certain Middle East countries are already either overweight or obese. It is completely incredible, the level at which we're operating. And actually, some of these countries have the second and third highest diabetes rates in the world. And if one actually, you want to know what Europe's like, well, I know some of you may know where England is. It's just arrowed there. There's a huge range. And top, a Mediterranean country, Greece. So much for the Mediterranean diet. Somebody's come from Mexico. It doesn't really affect the third world, does it? Mexico is trying to beat the United States now in terms of obesity. And this is the epidemic that's only swept through us in the last 20 or 30 years. Something quite extraordinary has been going on. We now reckon that we're up to 1.5 billion. I reckon it's nearer 2 when we've got all the data together. And it's going helter-skelter. This is the children. In that case, North America is up at the top, but Europe's pretty rotten. And when we put to the EU platform the data showing that Mediterranean children are much fatter than children in the north, they couldn't believe it. Because, of course, the Mediterranean diet is disappearing. And, in fact, if you try to intervene in Brindisi, for example, and give normal Mediterranean food to the kids, the parents object because they're going to starve. Where is the hamburger and chips for lunch? And it's going like crazy. The best data in the world come from Australia. And this is data from the 1900s onwards. This in children started essentially about 1985 in the Western world and about 1995 in the developing world. Therefore, quite astonishing things have been going on. I won't bore you with that, except it's true that if you're in the third world, in India, particularly Asia, and you put on a bit of weight, you have a risk of diabetes, which is 2 to 5 times that in the West, for reasons relating to malnutrition and so on, as Derek alluded to. But look at this. Why is this happening? And I'm grateful. This is Bangalore data from my good friend, Mario Vaz. Diabetes rates at the bottom, going up sevenfold. High blood pressure, up threefold. Heart disease, doubling. But look at the diet. Trebling of fat, fivefold increases, sixfold increases in sugar intake, fourfold increases in salt. This is comparing rural and urban areas. This is a catastrophic nutrition transition, and it's fueled by a dramatic change in the food systems and by the extraordinary westernization of the diet, which is being heavily promoted by the food industry. There's the data. The latest, obesity now is number 3 in terms of risk factors in the Western world. Derek is right that in fact there's been a collapse in physical activity for all sorts of reasons, but we also then have the question of how much is the food industry and the food side involved and how much is physical activity. Let me just, I've gone into the food. The evidence is overwhelming, despite what you'll see in a second, about fat and sugar being remarkable nutrients for evading the appetite regulation in the brain. If you go, as we did, to talk to prime ministers in the Caribbean, appalled by the burden of ill health, you find that as the fat intake goes up across the world, so does obesity rates go up. But it's higher in the Caribbean, shown in red. Why? Because they have the most amazing sugar intake. And indeed, if you look at countries such as China, they're in a complete mess because they've been actively promoting the importation of Western systems of food. And in fact, Jamaica has gone from a remarkably low, typically third world fat intake, up to what is still classified as a low fat diet by us Westerners who can't understand what we're talking about because we take such a Western view of life. What actually determines food intake? I was taught by a senior representative of Nestle, a very good colleague whom I see repeatedly, month after month, at every conference that I ever go to. He said, Phil, get a grip. How do we actually sell things? Of course, you've got to have a reasonable product, but we price it advantageously. We actually make it pervasively available, and we market it like crazy. And that actually determines our bottom line. And in fact, that's been recognized for years, and there are food wars. And those of you who don't know about this, you really ought to read A Fast Food Nation, which is a brilliant account of the transformation in the food chain, so that in fact one can actually produce ever cheaper food and sell it with an intensity which is quite remarkable. So what we need to understand is that if you look at the corporate sector, and I'm coming back to the general corporate sector a bit later, we've got to recognize that the food system is enormously powerful, as Derek pointed out. It is not catastrophically powerful. It is extraordinarily powerful. Be careful, Phil. And as for where it is in terms of what they do, they absolutely know. Starbucks understood a long time ago that when we had the Irish bomb in the city, they had six Starbucks within the rebuilt area. If you have Starbucks everywhere, what do you drink? Starbucks. And actually, we have now transformed the whole way in which we live, deliberately by brilliant marketing techniques, so it's assumed that you eat on the run and you can walk down the street with something in your hand to eat and drink. That's all very recent, and it's all part of a strategy. A strategy built on intense marketing, and the most brilliant marketeers whom I've been listening to, trained actually by the food industry, who can knock everybody into a cocked hat when you compare it with Department of Health efforts at the moment. I mean, it's just a complete joke. It's a nonsense. And they use personalities and so on. I don't know which company this is. But this, for some of you who don't know soccer, soccer's quite influential. And I wanted to know, because I had to debate with Derek, and this is not just getting a Pepsi. I wanted to know what the relative turnover was of all these different products, and I've now got a 20%. But if you look at the Quaker and actually and all these other goodies, what the prominent thing is that is advertised, I got this on Saturday from the website, is the soft drinks. So that must, in my terms, have something to do with a net profit. Now, if you look, for example, at the United States, which is in such a mess, they're struggling to try to cope with this. You find that if snacks, salty, cookies, candies, this hundreds of calories are now being consumed by the young. It's no wonder, if I looked at that first ever slide, the epidemic of obesity goes up dramatically from the age of 20 right through to the age of 60. My, oh, my. And curiously enough, the poorer you are, the more you eat of this stuff. And the reason relates to actually selective marketing but also the fact it's cheap and energy dense, so you can actually satisfy your appetite for a really remarkable few pence. So the big issue is, how are we going to cope with this? And I'm talking about food. Corina Hawke said, you know, I always used to talk about agriculture, but I actually had to work in it for years. And I then got, and I've been working with or listening to the food companies for many years. But what we're beginning to realize is that supermarkets have an enormous part to play. And you have to understand, if you're in the food business, that you need to distinguish between the global actors and the hundreds of thousands, indeed millions, of small food companies that are just operating on a local basis. And I think, therefore, we've got to be careful when we talk about the corporate sector that we make distinctions between these different actors. Walmart. I didn't know, actually, that Walmart has a GDP greater than 160 countries. Is it any wonder that they control the agenda of the United States government and actually many other governments? They actually know how to market originally portion size and so on, cost, and then to children. You put them below the parental eye. These are very modern new developments. Here's Kellogg's, and I could spend hours giving you illustrations. Kellogg's, a highly respectable company, working with Lego to produce playthings for children, which are actually based on confectionery. And actually, much more interesting and important to me, because it's obvious that children have been targeted for years now, is that actually they're targeting you and me. Despite your brilliance, your intelligence, your education, and so on, did you know that they'd get you, if not by simply plastering a supermarket so that you just happen to pick it up? But there's a new techniques. And Deborah Cohen, who's given me a lot of these slides, she's actually about to produce a book showing there are 20 different techniques for getting around what you think is an intelligent choice by yourselves. But you can monitor how many microseconds you stay monitoring a particular brand as you go into a supermarket. And my goodness, you can show remarkable... Oh, we're talking about, you know, 0.2 of a second. Okay? Who stops? And we monitor these things, and they can tell you why one brand picks up only 41% of consumers and another practically 100. This is brilliant neuromarketing of the most sophisticated type. To adults, please, not children. And if we look, Derek and I ran a big symposium where we chaired a debate on the future of the food world. But we also had a special meeting in Johannesburg. And I went up, being a bumbling guy I am, and I said, to five companies, talking to people represented on the board or talking directly to the board, I said, what's your biggest priority? They said, it's penetrating the third world. I've just been finishing for WHO an analysis of trade issues in Thailand. Thailand's in a catastrophic state because of the extraordinary transformation of their food system. I mean, this, you know, it's a bit unfair of me to pick up on Pepsi, but actually the main profits are being made in the international dimension. Whether you're talking about Tesco or most companies, they're absolutely obsessed with penetrating the third world. Oh, and if in fact people try to stop it, well, you can always rely on the US government until a few days ago to come in on their behalf. Now, you're bored with me talking about the United States. Let me cheer you up with the response to the Food Standards Agency, quite a useful organization, which is now threatened if the opposition party wins power after this election. And, you know, when they try to say, let's look at energy, fat, and so on, here's the response. We don't understand why the focus on sugar. There's no evidence at all. despite WHO producing the evidence. And, of course, our dear friends British Sugar, Mars and Food and Drink Federation, who have been long-standing in their opposition to any health initiative. I'm not going back years. If you go to what about targets, they're not necessary because we've already reformulated. It's driven by consumer response. You mustn't stifle innovation. You mustn't demonize various food groups. And so it goes on. Got it? A few companies involved in that response. Why am I feeling so tired? Why do I have such an old-fashioned view? Because the new world is going to be changed. Thank goodness. So I thought I'd come up to date. And a few days ago, this is the response to salt reduction from the Grocery Manufacturers Association of America. And it's quite astonishing. I don't know if it's out yet. Derek probably knows. But it actually does everything to sabotage any initiative at all. And specifies that really what we want is a major trial to see if salt reduction improves health before we make any moves. If you're in trouble and people are getting troublesome, you get them on your advisory committees. And Marion Nestle has described how most of the nutritional world spends its time in company advisory committees. Our dear local supermarket in Thailand is involved in a huge series of lawsuits, and they will deal with any opposition, folks. I better be careful what I say. Milton Friedman, I should have had a clip. There's a gorgeous piece where he says, social marketing, a brilliant marketing ploy, because it diffuses the opposition to something and can improve your returns. Otherwise, you're an idiot if it doesn't. Now, let's get away. What can we do? You can actually label food properly. Traffic lights, brilliant development by the Food Standards Agency, opposed systematically by a whole series of members of the food industry. GDA labelling, particularly by Tesco. GDA is a load of nonsense and is not understandable. Supermarkets have shown that if you manipulate, reformulate to change, whether you've got green lights or red lights, consumers respond, whatever their education, whatever their social group. And actually some companies are now introducing that. So, you know, don't condemn every corporate sector in either the food business or the supermarket business. That's the dilemma we do have. But, I mean, what a welter of different ways of doing it. And what we now need, Derek said we have to change things. I agree. But we now need nutrient profiling, a new concept based on traffic light type of concept, which don't just apply to labelling, but actually influence decision making right across and through the food chain. What gets into places and so on. Only then are we going to make progress. Marketing restrictions, we have voluntary restrictions, they don't in general. Perhaps there's a big change in the United States. We like to see the improvement in the US. But on the whole, the evidence from numerous analyses by the British government is that voluntary restriction does not work. And actually, big business operates through governments, even at the WHO level. Let's reduce marketing and the promotion of unhealthy products, says WHO and its executive board. US insist on promote responsible marketing so you can still get in at the kids, but actually you're being responsible all along. So in conclusion, big business has an enormous role to play. We have to distinguish between big business and the food sector and the physical activity sector. But when we actually are coming to the food and car and so on the whole, the evidence so far, I'm glad that it's changing, is that they restrict and sabotage most public health initiatives. And that's the dilemma for us, because they're so powerful, they actually control most governments Not this one, of course, here in the UK. So we now need new targets. We do need new targets to help the food industry. And we need specified targets for changing the whole of the nutrient composition of the food chain in sequential steps. And you can do this, and in discussions with some of the big industrial players, that's what they would prefer. Governments should only allow foods of a high nutritional quality to be sold in any of their premises or anything organisation supported by them. It would transform the demand side of the food supply chain. There are a whole series of things that corporations do and can do, from providing facilities for getting on bikes to work, to changing their own food policies, to providing creches for breastfeeding mothers, and we need criteria for nursery schools, and of course for schools and so on. We have the opportunity to make a big change, but unless we understand that the NGO and government process is a fundamental locking as part of initiatives and innovation, then I'm afraid the global nutrition transition, fed and fueled by an international food business that is desperate to keep its three-month bottom line increasing, that, I think, is going to hold sway unless we transform the way in which we think and indeed act. Thank you.
Presentation. Could I invite Derek and Phil to come up here? And this is your opportunity really to ask some questions of the two speakers or to make your own views clear if you like. But, so please say who you are when you raise your hand. So I don't know if you could hear at the back, but the first issue was to Derek about credibility and how can he demonstrate credibility, and the second was, can Phil envisage a landscape without the food industry and what would it look like? So Derek, you first.
Well, let me answer Phil's question first. I think we all know what a landscape without the food industry would look like. Global famine and a return to the unsafe food conditions of the past, where there's a lack of security about where your food was going to come from unless you were extremely wealthy and had access to the land. That's the reality. How can you trust us? You know, last week we had a meeting in Dallas, called the Cultural Center of the Universe, where we brought together 500 of our leading people from marketing, R&D, and innovation, and business. And what struck me was that if any of you had been in that meeting, I think your mindset would have been blown out of the water. Because you had 500 people discussing in detail how is the corporation going to address the fact that there are 1 billion people in the world who are hungry and 1 billion who are overweight and obese, explicitly, led from the CEO, supported by the heads of marketing around the world, by the heads of R&D around the world, by the heads of finance, operations, distribution. Obviously, I can't give you the details of the discussion, but to actually hear not just a discussion, but to see a range of very specific policies and plans starting to unfold suggested to me that we had actually come an extraordinary long way to actually move from what is still a discourse about can you or can't you trust to seeing large, serious investments in human capital, in the way we're actually working, in the kind of ways we're going to move ahead starting to take shape. I would love to actually see how we could actually get you to have that kind of better discussion of what is inside the mind of an industry, because it's not as simple as one can portray sitting inside academia. When I sat inside academia, whether it was at Yale or back in South Africa, it was very easy to paint the world as we versus them, and that all of them were bad, and what they were trying to do was to reach out and get everybody in the third world fat and obese. Remember that our biggest pressure doesn't come from the NGO community. It doesn't come from the academic community. It comes from our own investment community. When the JP Morgan Insights Group produced a report ranking food companies in terms of their obesogenic potential, our CEO and the heads of the companies, including the finance officer, take note and start investing in ways of reversing it. Because we know that our long-term viability depends upon starting to address the obesity epidemic, not in ways that are going to satisfy The Lancet or academia, but are going to satisfy Wall Street and the major investors in our company for the long term, because our viability depends upon ensuring that we start addressing what are regarded as the huge epidemics of our time. We accept entirely all the data Phil has given. And in fact, myself, Rob, John, many of my colleagues in this room present this data day on, yet day out to our sales force, our marketing force, and try and get us a marginal shift to start saying what they're going to do about it. I would just end this point by saying it's very easy from the outside to portray an entire corporation as a group of people intent on doing harm to the world. But just think about what drives our share price and what drives our viability in the market. What drives it is exactly long-term the kind of factors that you're trying to achieve, which is achieving better health goals simultaneous with profitability, I might add.
Okay. Phil.
I think the food industry is extremely valuable. That was developed, particularly in the UK, for example, as a positive decision post-war by the government. I think that the third world, lower-income countries, need to have established a nutrient profile which they actually lock in to the fundamental, what they allow in a whole variety of outlets. And working with business, they can then get private business to establish those same guidelines. And that will therefore not have the constant marketing of soft drinks and high-fat foods and so on. But there's nowhere in the world that's yet got to that point. In terms, let me just point out, JP Morgan, when our poor friend wrote that report, the chairman of Coca-Cola, the next morning, rang up the chairman of JP Morgan, said, sack this guy. Why was the investment industry worried? As he said, it's all to do with whether regulation is going to limit the profits of these companies. That, Derek, is why there is a pressure. That's why one needs to recognize that actually things are changing. And now the latest JP Morgan analysis was different. And social marketing and analysts that some of us have been to, they do rank companies as moving. But some of them are putting up a wonderful camouflage and a smoke screen, whereas others are genuinely moving. That's why we need to distinguish. But it's tough.
Okay. Now, I think you had your hand up next. Yes.
I have a question for Mr. Jack.
Could you say your name? Yeah, your name.
In fact, I listened to. I'm a bit surprised because when I listened to the figure of the expense you have done for to modify your product compared to the benefit of the company, it's a very, very small piece of the cake. And the thing is that I have as well the feeling that physical activity, diet, it's marketing as well. So it means that now we can maybe expect as well Pepsi to create some fair trade, organic, diet, light, crisp, and soda. And I don't really have the feeling, I don't believe to your commitment to the health cause.
Okay.
Super. But not much I can do about it. But I do think that if you really want the data, we'll give it to you. I'm not sure you can say it's trivial to say you've taken 2,400 tons of salt out of the diet of Britons in the last couple of years, or reduced the saturated fat level of our chips by 70% over the last couple of years, or wiped out the trans fat, and I can go on and on and on. Or stopped all marketing of full-calorie Pepsi and only marketing Pepsi Max in the brand in this country, which was, by the way, a bit of a misleading ad that Phil put up there. That actually doesn't exist in the UK. I don't think you can say those are trivial things. Each one of those steps took large investments, and they are both a sign of the commitment of the company to health, but they're also, quite obviously, a long-term commitment to where we hope our investors are going to place confidence in the company. And I can repeat that country by country by country.
Okay, yes, at the end of the row there. Yes, you.
Okay.
No, sorry, it's the lady behind you.
Good. Hello, I'm Amina, I'm from the Department of Epidemiology and Public Health at UCL. I'm an idealist and an optimist, and I'd like to believe what you say. And I think you believe what you say.
She must be talking about me.
Just tell you that some of you may know about the Sarbanes-Oxley law in the US, which is to deal with financial disclosure and the need for financial books to be verifiable by independent sources. That also applies to non-financial pledges. We are a US-based multinational. When we make a pledge, whether it's financial or non-financial, we know that we will be tested in the court of law as to whether we apply what we say we're going to do. And that's why we are very cautious, often the last company on the block to make a pledge, because we want to be certain that what we say we're going to be implementing. And when we see it actually not being abided by in a country, there will always be infringements. You can be sure that there'll be swift and ruthless action, often resulting in a change in the marketing company, which has happened recently. Your more fundamental question, though, around how can we be certain about this voluntary acts working in the developing world, and wouldn't it be easier to take the regulated route? Certainly my experience in tobacco control suggests that law on the books is in no way related to law on the streets, even though we may want it to be. So governments in many parts of the world will take what is often the easiest option to put a law on the books without putting the implementing capability in place, the oversight of NGOs, the capability of independent checking out there to ensure that it's in place. What happens under that scenario is that the only ones who apply the letter of the law tend to be the multinationals hosted in countries where they come under the complete rigor of the law, or they're subject to NGO vigilance. Our approach is to say, we'll continue to see progression of regulations of different kind, but we aren't waiting. We're saying that in the area of marketing to kids, we can today agree to stop marketing to children, and we've got certain criteria we'll be using. We will do it in all markets around the world, every market. And of the nine companies I mentioned, only one is from a developing country, and that is from Mexico, Bimbo of Mexico, a very large food company. We know that by having Bimbo on board, we're already signaling the fact that the largest regional and country player is joining multinationals, and that'll increase the potential for compliance. Because what our intent is not only to work at a global level, but within every country in which we operate, to try and bring together the corporate players responsible for food marketing in that country, and in time, get them around the table to have a competitive discussion about who is violating the code. And the strongest group watching over it will actually come from the companies themselves, because they don't want to see somebody following uncompetitive behavior. Is that likely to work? I believe it will work, because there's a competitive reason to make it work, which relates to our bottom line. And has it worked in the past? We can give you examples in other realms where it certainly worked very effectively, at much lower cost, at much faster speed, and particularly in countries where the budgetary capability of government to do anything in chronic diseases is minimal. Let me just add by saying, when I was in WHO, the current Assistant Director General, Alwan, and I did a very interesting survey worldwide. We looked at 185 countries and looked at their capacity to carry out policy, health promotion, regulatory activity in the area of chronic diseases. That capacity was virtually, if not zero, in the vast majorities of the developing world. That would include their capacity to regulate, to implement regulation. Yes, they could get it onto the books, but it would probably have no perceptible benefit on the streets. That's why I believe we need to start looking at better approaches, and whether we want to trust industry or not is not the point. If you agree to independent verification and you agree to the audit company being involved, you can be sure that you will have a report which will show whether or not they're doing it. And we're quite happy to find ways of bringing in third-party NGO players to be at the table as well.
Okay, Phil?
The collapse of the banking system might give us hope, but I'm already sensing that people are beginning to get round it. And in the political framework of the debate at the highest political level, they don't transfer that experience to the appropriateness of intervention in other domains. So my guess is that although in theory the economic crisis and so on should be allowing us to rethink, already I'm seeing signs that we're slipping back and not realizing that you need the benefit of the big power blocks, you need the benefit of the free market, but you also need societal involvement with local, regional and national government, setting the scene so that only within those criteria do governments operate. Derek's quite right that in the third world, I spend my life there, it's extremely difficult to actually see how things can be implemented effectively and developed. But I have to tell you, given that environment, what I see of international food companies, and I'm talking to the main board of international food companies, and I'm giving them just as tough a time as Derek gives to his colleagues. They're actually pretty amazed. But when you look in the detail at where they get paid their bonuses, it's for turnover and so on. So the implications don't go down, even though the top people think that they've got a coherent plan. That's my problem with it.
Yeah, Martin McGill, at the School of Hygiene Tropical Medicine. I'd like to continue the theme, if I may, but focus on a specific. And Phil was reminding us that the three drivers of sales are the price of availability and marketing. I was in Bangalore in Mali in November, and I could buy a diet version of a well-known cola brand in the International Hotel I was staying in. It was 50% higher in price than the sugared version of it. If I went out in the streets, I couldn't buy the diet version. version anywhere at all. It was entirely the sugary version, and that the marketing was entirely for that version. Why?
It's an absolutely critical question, Martin, and I wish I could give you a simple answer. But I think it relates to a fundamental debate we're having. Let me just step back one second and say, I think that till now, we have seen that most decisions about pricing, availability, marketing, and even product composition have been driven by marketing. That's been the history of most food companies. We're at this very exciting transition point where the guardrails are being handed, certainly in the case of our company, and my colleagues here can verify that, to people with a background in science, research, and development. And that's going to set up very interesting discussions, where often the marketing people's incentives, as Phil said, are very different from our incentives, or the incentives on the other side of the house. There would be no incentive for them to be thinking expressly about boosting diet on Pepsi Max in many parts of the world, unless it was made an explicit part of their work agenda. We believe that can be done, and we're starting to look in a number of countries at how we can actually start correcting that imbalance. You're absolutely right that for historical reasons, you've gone out with brand full calorie first, and then you've come on later with the diet or the low volume effects. We're now seeing that in parts of the world, we're actually able to go out faster with the healthiest part of the beverage portfolio. Look at Brazil, at the dramatic advance of a product called H2O, which is a water juice combination with extremely low levels of sugar. It's taken off, but it's also taken off because we've done the decent consumer insight work needed for marketing to drive it. We still don't fully understand why it is, in the case of Mali, in the case of many of the minority communities in the US, we don't understand why it is that the perception of the diet and the low-calorie brand as being less healthy than the full-calorie and more less desirable continues to be the case, despite every effort by our marketers to reverse that. This is something which we think we could be working with academics on to try and understand how we can make that shift. That's not an easy shift. There's some deep-set reasons for it. I think that it also raises perhaps a bigger reason, and I think my colleagues hopefully will agree with me, that while we are making progress on product reformulation to try and bring a wider range of options with lower salt, sugar, and fat, we have yet to start making the same level of investment in different business models which do allow the healthiest option to be the option that is priced the easiest and marketed the most. That is a big shift inside any company, and it's obviously going to take some very careful thinking before we can get it right. But it's starting.
Okay, take your question next.
Jackie Sherry from Sustain. As well as working for Sustain, I'm also a part of teacher, and I'm going to go to school tomorrow to teach. And I know, and it's a primary school, and I know a huge percentage of my class will have watched The Bill, Coronation Street, very popular programmes on commercial channels. And in those advert breaks, they will see repeatedly adverts for junk food. Now, we've had this big debate about banning the advertising and the marketing of junk foods to young children. And so far, the industry have banned them around children's programmes. But we know that actually lots of children watch programmes which aren't deemed just children. So can't food companies actually respect the watershed when children are likely to be ready to be watching, not to advertise them? And the whole argument about not advertising, I mean, I'm sorry to do this to you, but look, I found this cute little cartoon there, got little puppet characters on your website, the Pepsi, which, you know, you say you don't advertise and market. Now, honestly, much as the adults here like them, you know, the kids, you know, we love them out and we're interested. And just finally, I too am not cynical. And I think what we need to do is take, you know, learn by action. When you're willing to, when companies are able to say, yes, you know what, we're going to step away from those marketing techniques. You know what, we're going to invest in physical activity, but we're not going to brand it. I run a women's football team for middle-aged football moms who've never played football, who never do any other advertising, sorry, any other exercise. We would love some funding, and yet I'm not going to wear a logo advertising junk food. There are huge numbers of things that you could do that would take forward. When companies do that, I will say yes. They have a part to play. But until then, I'm afraid I think we have every right to be skeptical, and regulation is absolutely needed.
Let me just say, I would like to hand one of those puppets to the man sitting in front of you by the name of Andrew, and we would like to take it forward and get some action on it and get back to you. Second. Second, let me say that we are through the Change for Life program. I know it's subject to a lot of debate. We are, in an unbranded way, making sure that the athletes who we have on our books are available to try and push the case of physical activity across the country. That's in addition to the Magic Breakfast program running in a number of schools. And we can see that being expanded. In many parts of the world, we support the equivalent of physical activity programs, a very large support for the YMCA in Latino and African American communities in a completely unbranded way. And I could go on. We're doing the same in Mexico, in South Africa, in Russia. That is certainly the spirit of the way the company wants to move. And again, later we could give you more details of what the contribution of Change for Life is.
Okay, right. I think we'll take your question now.
I think on gain, I think that's an unfortunate example because the chair of the corporate board is Paulus Fiskeren from Unilever, and I think through the technical competence of Unilever, quietly done without many people knowing, we have seen the business acumen of gain move to actually assure that you are reaching 650 million kids who otherwise would not be receiving micronutrients and would suffer the brain effects of that. I prefer to take the marginal risk of actually saving the brains of children then worrying about the theoretical fear that there may be a halo effect on Unilever and the other products, whether it's DSM and the other microfix companies. That may be, that's my choice, may not be yours. I think in the era of partnership, I agree with you that one needs to be very cautious about the way we use the word partnership and how you characterize the relationship. And in the case of WHO, the relationship we have between the nine companies and WHO is not a partnership. It's at the moment a dialogue, a series of discussions, and an interaction. In the case of Merck, World Bank, and WHO in eradicating river blindness in West Africa, that is a partnership where I cannot see that it could be characterized badly in any other way. If Merck happens to get the halo effect for dramatically changing the lives of millions of people in West Africa, or to the good, I would say, and incentivize companies to go down that direction. But make sure there's a firewall between them doing that and influencing the broader pharmaceutical or IP policy of WHO, which I know is your concern. I would also say that, and you know that I've always admired and drawn upon the very work that you've spent your life doing, promoting breastfeeding worldwide. And I continue, maybe the word partnership is the wrong word, but I continue to challenge to know what would a responsible breastfeeding policy of a food company look like? How would it be accepted as responsible if we were to do things by the book? Because I don't know if you fully appreciate that. If you could give us an answer to that, it would unlock untold potential of our corporations to invest in addressing the under 3 nutrition problem, which is having a huge impact on a billion kids worldwide.
Here, let me take a question. I think you, yes, you sir.
My name is John Tracy. I'm with the Oxford Health Alliance. And I've, 2 years ago, retired from a company called Procter & Gamble, which they may be known to face friends here as possible. External relations for Pringles and Sunny Delight. So that makes me friends with everyone. Despite that, I have to take exception with the food industry being equated with the tobacco industry, brackets, alcohol, gun running in France. I think there's quite a huge difference. I'm absolutely vehemently agreeing with you that partnership with WHO and other organizations needs to be handled extremely carefully. Part of my assignment was to see how can Procter & Gamble globally interact with WHO effectively, ethically, and responsibly. And I spent most of my time internally stopping people trying to do things unethical and short-term silly, because there's no point in trying to pull a fast one on a WHO, getting some sort of endorsement and then losing the benefit of that for the future. The other part of it is, and it's a vote of sympathy and a question to the whole audience is, what do you want? It is very difficult to change any organization in this world. Just think of where you're coming from right now. You need to make a major change to that. You're going to have to stand up against the flow and come up with reasons on a personal level, and you fight a crusade. I'll show you the scars afterwards. However, the question that I place to you here is, if these corporations are successful, it's because there is a reward system that is out there that encourages and motivates them to move in that direction. If we can see some way of encouraging a confluence of interest, we always talk about conflicts, but there's a confluence of interest, you'd be very surprised at how quickly these things happen. So rather than, by all means, criticize when people are not delivering on their promises, but if the promises are becoming increasingly in the direction which you want to, I highly recommend that we encourage that. There will be others in the organizations that may be competitive who don't go that way. The CEO of Coca-Cola doesn't have that job anymore, does he? So I think please be very careful, and when you see something that is worthwhile encouraging, why not encourage it instead of regulating and killing it?
So Phil, perhaps I can ask you to respond. Can there ever be a confluence of interest between public health and the food industry?
Yes, there can indeed be a confluence of interest, but the criteria for what relates to health has to reside with the health people. And your point about you have to be very careful, you've actually given a beautiful illustration of the dilemma for major part of the food sector that for 30 or 40 years have been going like a meltdown, as we say in Wales. I mean, just an absolute bombshell coming at you the whole time. And to try to change that, and what Derek is claiming is that Pepsi, he's not just a clever marketeer trying to sort of fob us off, you know. He genuinely believes, and he's producing evidence now, that Pepsi's on the move. The big issue is, how can we get all these other companies on the move? And I went very briefly by saying, I think if you talk to the big international companies, which I think have actually, quite often without realizing it, in promoting their current portfolio to the third world, they're inducing enormous harm. The point is, though, that they need to be set criteria which are explicit and relate to health. And they actually understand that. And if you made that clear over a period of time that's not stupid, as many characters want, instant this, that, and the other, but on a 3 to 5 year period, and you know it's going to happen, that actually is of enormous benefit, and the biggest companies are going to do particularly well. So actually, in the third world, the big question for me is, how do I support the development of food industries in the lower income countries that are based on local foods and so forth with the appropriate nutrient content that actually goes with their original dietary pattern? And that's not always associated with malnutrition. And that is actually a huge challenge, which I've talked to economic and social development boards in different countries. And most people don't understand how to do that.
Let me take one last question. Well, perhaps we'll just roll these two up then to one. So if yours first and then yours.
Great. I'm Jim Webb from the United States, in the state of Maine, where we have a small farm that is having some success in encouraging people in Maine to eat local food. So rather than processed food, and it seems to me that our
just take one more question. We'll take the two together.
Thank you for your visit. My name is Andrew. I'm a student at LSHTM. My question in some ways relates to that, but a big factor in a lot of the processed foods has been the role of cheap corn, particularly in the U.S., and how this relates to fructose added to a lot of food. I'd be interested, Dr. Lee, your opinion about how public health can be involved in addressing an issue that
okay, Phil, I think perhaps you first and then Derek.
Local food is actually a big problem. When I tried to do this in Britain, I spoke to with the top supermarkets and so on. Why were they actually importing everything from abroad? And what it turned out was that the farming community had been so trained with government policies to actually go for monoculture, and they actually didn't know how to provide that array of local foods. In Chile, they've changed the policies, for example, where local schools get local farmers, and the farmers have benefited, and actually it's not been a net cost to the country. So that is actually a big issue, which I'm trying to get local government and school arrangements to recognise that that's a very important point. In terms of subsidies and trade laws, there's a whole series of supplement that we're writing at the moment, which will come out, which shows that we examined this with CARICOM, the economic group of the Caribbean, and actually trade laws could be used, but the problem is that Codex, the international monitor, doesn't actually allow for fat, sugar and salt being designated as good or bad or anything like that. And to get anything in Codex is a nightmare, and that needs to be changed. I tried to persuade over 5 hours Gro Brundtland to take it on, and she wouldn't, because actually the whole problem of Codex is it always has to be unanimous, and it takes about 15 years to do anything. So, I mean, I think that we could begin to look at that. The subsidies and so on have been used for decades by governments, and they make a difference, but nobody's thought of now transforming that decades of experience into a positive mode. Trade could be handled in a different way, but often it's foreign direct investment that has caused the actual dramatic changes in third world food patterns.
Eric, quick response to those questions?
I think they really undercut what is an interesting convergence which is occurring in our company between the focus on environmental and health sustainability. And while I said I was talking about our own R&D and so on, we also have within our new R&D capability teams looking at long-term research. And I think if you were to ask them what's top of their list, the removal of anything artificial, the increasing focus on local production, local sourcing, and local processing. Proof of that is certainly starting to take shape inside our potato culture. Potatoes don't lend themselves to be shipped around the world, so we tend to grow them locally, use them locally. Often we grow them so locally that we can say in the US, as we're starting to say, which farms do your potatoes and your packet of chips come from? The same's going to happen in the fruit and vegetable arena before long. In other parts of the world, we may not be doing local in terms of that particular state, but certainly within the country. And people forget that PepsiCo is not a company that mixes strange chemicals in a test tube. It's a company that's really based on agriculture. We have vast farms in Outer Mongolia that are teaching people to plant potato, corn, rice in a sustainable way, both for themselves as well as to supply to us. Or similarly, in India, we've been able to both provide farming capability to improve local production to farmers at the very bottom of the pyramid, but also be a source of, be the client for them as well. And incidentally, while doing that, we've actually had to reinvent new ways of irrigation, one being a reduction of 40% of the traditional water runoff in a rice paddy field in India, which is now going to have implications across the entire subcontinent of India with massive water savings. It's only a company of the scale, size, and vision of PepsiCo that could do that. If you're going to leave it to small-scale farmers alone, you simply will not make the progress either on the environment side or the long-term human sustainability. And let me end by saying that the search for greater understanding of natural and food ingredients is not just happening in the paddy fields of India or wherever it might be. It's happening by studying the Ayurvedic texts of India or understanding Chinese traditional medicine or going into the Amazon to understand the use of traditional herbs and medicines, which is a formal part of our R&D agenda. The goal not being to come up with some clever little product that will get into your chip, but to come up with the kind of foods that we can actually bring to people, both in the local culture and internationally, that would meet new nutrient guidelines.
Well, we need to draw things to a conclusion now. Maybe I can ask the two speakers to give us one sort of soundbite to end on, one point they'd just like to emphasize. Maybe, Phil, I'll turn to you first.
The food crisis, that there's a conference happening in Madrid now, relating to poverty and so on. The fact is that we haven't got a coherent integration of our understanding about the fundamentals of food price and food policy locked in with development. And unless we get a coherent scheme whereby we can see how to cope with both malnutrition and this problem, we're not really going to make headway. And it is our responsibility, yours and mine, to develop much more coherent and effective policies and persuade government that they can then invoke the help of big industry to actually pursue those, but not to be controlled by them in determining what the policies really are in practice.
I'm pleased Phil mentioned the conference. The reason I'm not in Spain with the President of Spain, but here, is because I thought this audience was more important. I was on the committee that wrote the report to the President of Spain with Jeff Sachs and his team, and one of the few corporate partners giving inputs into the way we are going to address the needs of the poorest billion of the world. That, we believe, is something that may be a little bit beyond us. What we do believe is within our scope is to continue the engagement that we have in this audience. And why one soundbite is to take up the offer of my colleague over there, Rob Hargrove, who will make to every one of you as you walk out, to go and visit him in our laboratories up in Beaumont Park, and then make a decision as to whether we are serious or not serious. Come and look at what we are doing, not what we're saying or what we're claiming to do, but look at what we're doing, and then tell us whether you're convinced about the change. Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you both very much. Can I just end by advertising two things? One is this Lancet series on trade and health that I think will be of great interest to many of you in the audience. It came out last week. A few copies at the front. Kelly Lee and Richard Smith were very much instrumental in putting that together, and with great help from Rona McDonald of the Lancet. Also to inform you that if you'd like to catch up with this discussion again, this is being filmed and it will be on the website, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine website. Could I finally ask you to join me in thanking both of our speakers.